On behalf of the church, we would like to extend sympathy to the Keno family on the passing of Mrs. Keno's aunt, Miss Lois Hall. Kenos have been active in the church for some time. They were charter members, and they've been active off and on. We do express sympathy in the passing of Miss Lois Hall. I want to emphasize that one of the announcements, orientation dinner meeting, which is set for Saturday at 6 o'clock, is very important. It's an orientation dinner meeting for new members, especially those who have joined recently since September. But any new member who has not been to an orientation meeting is urged to attend. We like to have some idea about whether or not it's going to be possible for you to attend. If you're a new member, we'd like you to sign up with Ms. Dorothy Williams, Mrs. Louise Howell, or Ms. Annabelle Washington, or let me know if you can't find them. That's because there is a dinner connected with the orientation. We will have dinner promptly at 6 o'clock, and following that, there will be a general orientation for new members, a discussion of how the church operates, how it functions, an introduction of officers, of area group chairmen, of departments, and an opportunity for new members to ask questions. We think this meeting is important, and we hope that new members will make a special effort to try to be present. That's Saturday of this week at 6 o'clock. On Friday of next week, December 16th at 7 o'clock, we have what we call each year the Hanging of the Green, at which time each area group cooperates in decorating the church for Christmas. And each area group is assigned a certain specific responsibility, such as decorating a tree in the sanctuary or one of the trees in the fellowship hall or in the lounge. So each area group will, in the letter that goes out this week, be given a specific responsibility, and we hope that the members will cooperate with the area group chairman in making this a happy occasion on Friday, December 16th. Now, we've done some reorganizing of our area groups, not a complete reorganization, but some reorganizing. And we expect that each area group chairman will contact the members of the area group as quickly as possible so that if any changes have been made, you'll know what group you're in. And we hope also that in 1967 that members will take their area group responsibilities seriously, more seriously than many of you took them in 1966. During this Advent season, I've been trying to do something a little different from the traditional Christmas preparation, something a little different than just an inspirational meditation on the Christmas theme. Rather, I am concerned that you understand a little more clearly the meaning and the history of the Christmas season, Christmas Day itself, the coming of the Christ child into the world. And so from our candlelight Advent candle ceremony, I would take a text from the 18th verse, which was the beginning of our scripture reading, which was a part of our Advent candle ceremony. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. And then it proceeds to undertake a description of how the birth of Jesus Christ took place. I would like to point out that the birth of Jesus Christ certainly did not take place in the way pointed out, because there was no record of the birth of Jesus Christ. The birth of Jesus Christ was not celebrated, was not considered even to be important until the 3rd century following his death. And it was when the the birth of Jesus Christ came to be important to Christian people, that they reached back and out of oral tradition and what people remembered, they put together the account which is in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. And in the Gospel of Mark, there is no account of the birth of Jesus Christ at all, except his spiritual birth at baptism. It begins with the baptism of Jesus in the River Jordan by John the Baptist. And the Gospel of Mark, of course, is the oldest gospel, and this begins with the spiritual baptism of Jesus Christ. Assuming, of course, then that his early physical birth was not too important as compared with this baptism, which symbolized his birth and his acceptance by God, his messiahship by God. I'd like to take a few minutes to go into some of the things that are in a little book called 4,000 Years of Christmas. 4,000 Years of Christmas. It's an authoritative account. I emphasize that. Earl W. Count, who is a doctor, PhD, teaches at Hamilton College, has done the study 4,000 Years of Christmas. Now, this may sound to you strange, because it's only 2,000 years since the life of Jesus. And yet this is an account which calls itself 4,000 Years of Christmas. And Dr. Count is professor of anthropology, and he's made a study of the beginnings of the observance of Christmas. In the prologue, it says, I can't read all of the parts I would like to read to you, but I'd like to take selected passages by way of acquainting you with a different conception, perhaps, of the beginning of Christmas. It says, this is one of the world's greatest stories. We do not know its beginning, and it has not yet ended. Much of the story is not known. For instance, we do not really know when the Christ child it venerates was born, or the time and place when Christmas was first celebrated, or exactly how it was that over the centuries a bishop saint of Asia Minor and a pagan god of the Germans merged to become Santa Claus. Although the Christmas story centers in the Christ child of Bethlehem, it began so long before his coming that we find its hero arriving on the scene after more than half of the time of the story has gone by. Now, for most of us, this is a peculiar thought. Still in the prologue, it says, it will tell us of an old Babylonian festival that moves westward, dividing its ways as it comes through Greece into Rome, as a festival that remodels itself at every step to fit the people among whom it settles, by another road into Israel, where at last it comes to rest beside the manger of Bethlehem, though not for long, since it then becomes part of the strength by which the faith of Christ conquered the entire pagan Mediterranean, and by yet another route that skirts these other two through the Balkans and up the Danube Valley, where much disfigured and impoverished, it enters into the heathendom of the Northland. Now, this is an account, then, of Christmas beginning, not really the observance, the things that go to make up our observance, beginning not really in Israel, not really in Bethlehem, but 2,000 years before, and gradually making its way to Bethlehem, and the customs making their way to Europe, to the Balkans, and gradually these customs being accepted throughout the world. And only after a long period of time being brought together as a Christmas celebration centered in the birth of Jesus Christ. Beginning, I hope you note, in Babylonia. I've tried to point out for the past several weeks the almost inescapable conclusion of any student that Jesus was undoubtedly a black prophet, that the people of Israel were undoubtedly black people. They were part of the ancient world, the world around the Mediterranean. And all of the peoples around the Mediterranean were dark people. And they were dark because they were a combination of the Asiatic upon the one hand and the black African upon the other. And black Africa pushed its way northward into Arabia, into Egypt. It eventually covered the entire continent of Africa, pushed its way clear across Israel, into Babylonia, into Assyria, mixing as it went with all of the peoples of these other lands, pushing finally even into Europe, into Greece. And to look at the people of Greece is to know that the people of Africa at one time passed through into Italy. Certainly to look at the complexion of the Italians is to indicate that at some point the black man from Africa passed through into Spain, where the Moors were a dominant factor in Spanish life for many years, and to realize that here again the black man had an influence. Now, these were not just journeys that black men were taking. There were armies, there were battles, they conquered, they mixed with the people of these various lands. And so the land around the Mediterranean became, in fact, the center of culture and a land of black men. And it's into this land, it's from this land that the entire conception of the Christ child, the customs of Christmas, even 4,000 years ago, come. Babylonia was a nation of black people. And Babylonia then, 4,000 years ago, was the beginning of the customs which finally became centralized in Christmas as we know it today, in Christmas which was centered in Jesus Christ, an old Babylonian festival that moves westward. I'd like to read just a passage. In all the rest of the world, there is no sea like the Mediterranean Sea. This is the sea which was the center of the ancient black world. Around it, many kinds of men have worked and played, fought, battled, and sung as nowhere else. There mankind first turned grass into grain. There, too, perhaps the first animals to carry loads and feed us from their flesh were made tame. Their metals first became tools and weapons. Their ships and cities and governments were invented. There the dark, clear eyes of priests first read the stately tale of the stars and set forth on the greatest of all voyages of discovery to seek the spirit who made the universe, who made the earth within the universe, who created the mind and body of man up in the earth. This is speaking of the Mediterranean Sea and the land about it, and the black people who made up the ancient world. Everything that exists came from this ancient world, first turned grass into grains, first domesticated animals, and first made wagons or carts upon which loads could be carried, first worked with metals, making tools and weapons, ships and cities and governments, inventing these things before they existed anywhere else in the world. Priests, scientists, and it speaks here of the wise men who understood the stars well enough to come seeking out the birth of the Christ child. And here was born then almost 2,000 years ago a boy whose mother was a peasant, whose cradle, says the story, was the feeding trough of cattle. Now this is an interesting little aside, because this book is written by a white man, although he admits more than most white men. He says there was another wise man. Now, this is in addition to the three that are told about in the Bible. There was another wise man who did not arrive from the east, but from the north. Now, coming from the north is from the cold, pagan, barren wastelands of Europe. This wise man came late from the land of the swift summer and long, slow winter, from the endless forest of fir and spruce and juniper and oak. As we shall see, he came only after the mild south wind had brought him its message. That is, he came only after the people around the Mediterranean had brought him a message. Perhaps that is why he could not be included in the New Testament story. Now, this is the white rider. The New Testament story which closed centuries before he arrived. Probably the wise men of the East would not have thought him rich or even wise. Now that's peculiar, because in our day we tend to think of all white men as being rich and wise and beautiful. But this white man admits that at that time these black wise men would not have considered these barbarians from the north wise or rich. In their day, he would have seemed even more uncouth and barbaric than the shepherds who had reached the manger first. And certainly they would have been more barbaric and uncouth, because they came from a more barbaric and uncouth land, from Europe. But in time, the other wise man, this is the wise man from the north, has brought his worship to the manger. Gifts of stone flung high into space in the slender shapes of solemn pointed arches and of glass colored to stain the light of the sun. This is talking about the cathedrals that came thousands and thousands of years later. But finally this wise man from the north, like the shepherd of Judea and the peasant of Italy, he has brought the gift of simple songs, songs which tramp the snowy streets on the silent holy night and enter into house and hall too lowly for vaulting stone and glowing window glass. The wise man of the north added also his old Yuletide, the boar's head. That's just a pig's head. Don't make it something fancy now, because that's what he ate. The boar's head which he took away from the feast of his old heathen god Frey, his yule log of Britain and Germany, and he commissioned Saint Nicholas, his master of ceremonies, and he made the Christmas tree and set it up beside the manger. Now this is the other wise man. This is the white wise man from Europe. Uncouth, barbaric, bringing his meager treasures 2,000, 3,000 years late. to the observance of the worship of the Christ child. The other wise men, with their gold, frankincense, and myrrh, might not have thought much of these gifts. But they had left before the man of the Northland arrived. This man, who was a slow and painful thinker. Listen to me now. This is the white man who came from the North, who was a slow and painful thinker. Way behind is what he's saying. Way, way behind in everything. Who took a long time to become wise, if he ever did. Conceived his gift over many centuries. Today, now this is a white man talking here. Today we regard his gift as no less worthy than the treasure of the Magi. That means we white people. I'm just reading it so you'll understand, you know, how they read right for each other. We know this gift as our own, for the wise man of the North, he is the people of the Northland. And many of us own his blood, and all of us, whatever our blood, have come into his heritage. Do you see how he took over Christmas, decided that what he'd added was more important than anything else, and made it his own holiday, his own celebration? Now it began 2,000 years even before the Christ child was born in Babylonia. All of the customs and tradition and the wisdom of the dark peoples around the Mediterranean made up the possibility of Christmas. The very idea that God existed apart from animation, apart from something that the savages believed, a spark in a tree. The very concept of a God who could govern the universe comes from this Mediterranean center of culture. The very concept that God could create a Messiah, could come into the world in a sense, could break into history, is an idea which could only have been born in this Mediterranean center of culture, among black people who were capable of thinking thoughts of divinity. It's a strange thing, isn't it, how far we've fallen in our conception of ourselves. How completely we've been misled into believing that we come from nothing, and that the man who was a savage, who had so little to contribute, who was so slow-witted and dull, how we've come to believe that he is almost godlike. Just a few more little passages. The beginning of the observance of Christmas really was the beginning of the observance of the New Year in Babylonia or Mesopotamia. In the New Year, they had a conception of the world. This is the ancient world, black people thinking about life. They had a conception of the world. New Year's was a time of crisis, they believed. Once in a very distant time, their chief god, Marduk, or Enlil, who was even more ancient than Marduk, had routed the monsters of chaos and had built out of a world without form and void an orderly world and had created man. Now this is very similar to the final Israelite definition of the creation of the world. But it was a concept of creation that existed in Babylonia thousands of years before it came to the Israelites in Israel. God had created an orderly world out of chaos. But the order remained an uneasy one. Now this is a very advanced and developed conception of life. The orderliness of the universe was a very uneasy orderliness that each year tended to run down. Each year, the orderliness of the universe tended to run down. That the conflict between good and evil tended always to be on the verge of being lost by the God of goodness. The God of evil tended always to be upon the verge of conquering goodness. The order remained an uneasy one. It ran down, so to speak, during the year towards its close. After the crops had been harvested, the empty brown of the fields told that life was dying. Then Marduk again had to do battle with the monsters of chaos, so that death might not become complete. Then he renewed the world every year. It was a grim battle fought in the regions below, and every time Marduk almost lost his struggle. Now this was the beginning of the observance of the new year, which eventually became our observance of Christmas. This eternal conflict between good and evil is a part of their basic conception of the world. And there are various other ideas which are a part of it. The idea of the scapegoat, which is familiar to us from the Old Testament. The scapegoat who takes on the sins of a people, takes on the sins of an individual. The idea of the scapegoat, which in a sense Jesus becomes for us in Christianity, was an idea which was prevalent in Babylonia at least 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. The idea of the mock king. Each year as Marduk fought for the triumph of righteousness in the world, the king would have to go back. The king would have to go back and ask God again to give him the power to rule for another year. He would be stripped of his raiment. And then in the temple, the priest would re-anoint him for his task for another year. They would go through many symbolic services. In a castle or in a wealthy man's home, the slaves would become masters for a period of time. And they would have a mock king who would reign and have all power during a limited period, during the 12 days of the New Year season or the Christmas season. And then at the end of the time, he would go back and he would be a slave again, indicating that the position that an individual holds in the world is a transitory position. That the individual does not hold his position eternally. But as good and evil struggle for ascendancy in the world, as Marduk struggled against the God of darkness, the individual went back and had to ask again for God's permission to govern for another year, and that the king might become the slave, and the slave might become the king. There are many festivals, and out of these festivals have come most of our traditions of Christmas, the giving of gifts, because as soon as it became certain that the God of light, of Marduk, had triumphed, then the God's triumph would be celebrated, and the people would exchange gifts, they would have parties, they would have great feasts. All of these were handed down and became a part of the observance of the Christmas season. And even the passing of New Year resolutions. As they went into the New Year, they would ask God, the God who had established again his power, his ascendancy, they would ask him for certain favors during the coming year, which we still do in terms of the New Year's resolution. And this was 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. And they would go about and they would sing songs in the street, much the same way as later the carolers went about singing the Christmas carols. As the custom went west, went to the northern barbarians, it was changed a bit. Ideas entered in, Roman ideas entered in, And it became sort of an orgy at Christmas time. An orgy because they had no limits to the kind of good times that they would have. And they took the idea of the mock king, which was a symbolic thing, and they made it a very real kind of horrible symbolism. And if they would take an individual, a convict, and make him a king for 30 days, and they would give him all the honor and pomp and ceremony of a king, but at the close of the 30th day, they would take him to the altar and sacrifice him. This was a part of the barbarism that entered into the observance of Christmas as Christmas moved into the barbaric lands of Europe and the Balkans. There was never any certainty as to the date, as to whether or not Jesus was born on the 25th of December. It was merely a church decision that picked the 25th of December. People had not the slightest idea. They observed the birth of Jesus on January the 6th for many years, because January the 6th was remembered as the time when Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan. They observed the birth of Jesus as late in the year as April at some time. Finally, the church decided upon the 25th of December because it was the center of the ancient customs, the new year, the low point of the sun for the year according to the Roman calendar. All of these things, the celebrations which people already engaged in, all of these made it very desirable for them to make the 25th of December the birthday for the Christ child. And so it was selected. It was selected by the church and declared, this is the birthday of Christ. And for many years they had to fight against the barbarism which characterized the observance, because the barbarians still carried over many of the very primitive ideas and customs which had been a part of their observance. The Gospels told of the Son of Man who walked in the sun and dust of the roads of Palestine. He healed the hurts of men, the hurts of body and soul. He called to himself those who labored and were heavy laden and promised them refreshment which no earthly power could give. But his followers could not keep in mind at once this Jesus. Now this is the Jesus who walked the dusty roads of Palestine, and the stern judge who sat on a throne in heaven. Now there is a contrast which we many times overlook. This Jesus, who was a humble individual, who went about doing good, who was kindly, who advised men how to live, this Jesus, as compared with the risen Christ, taught by the Apostle Paul, who rose into heaven and sat on the right hand of God the Father, and who would return as a stern judge to judge the good and the evil, the wicked. Now, it was very difficult to reconcile these two conceptions of Jesus. His followers could not keep in mind this Jesus of Palestine and this Jesus who sat on the throne in heaven and who would someday return in glory to deal an even-handed justice to all mankind. And it was a renewal of the world in this latter way and not a renewal of the heart in the former way which won. That they finally emphasized the Jesus of power who sat in heaven and who would judge rather than the Jesus who walked the dusty roads of Palestine. Now I think we have to, if we would draw any conclusions, we would say that for Jesus, who was the prophet, who taught, who preached, who healed, who helped people, who called his disciples, that for this Jesus, he was concerned with a way of life, with how men were to live together. He was concerned with values. He was concerned with ethics. The Jesus of heaven, who comes again to redeem, to reclaim, to judge, this Jesus is separate and apart from the simple Jesus who was concerned with the way of life. Now, for Jesus, the man who walked about, redemption was a process. We are redeemed by a process. There is not a time, a fixed time, when suddenly we are saved. Now, always we want it this way. We want there to be a date, a time, when everything is finished. A child wants to hurry up and grow up. A family usually thinks that one of these days we'll get our bills paid and the house paid for and the car paid for, and then we will begin to live. Most people in the church think that one of these days we'll pay off all our debts and everything, and then things will be easy. We all would like to think, to project some date in the distant future when things would work out, when there won't be all of these continuing problems of everyday existence. But for Jesus, there was in his everyday preaching and teaching a process of redemption. We are redeemed by the way we live. Not in terms of some set date, not in terms of something which is to happen someday, but we are redeemed daily by the way we live. Every day then becomes a redemptive process. Not 5 years from today, not 10 years from today, not sometime when we are old, when we can afford to put down the excitements of everyday living, when we no longer have the necessities of struggling for the necessities of life. Life is a process, a redemptive process, which goes on daily. Now, this is very important to us in many ways. As black people, it's important to us as we undertake a struggle for freedom. This concept of how does redemption come? Do we look forward to some day, some specific time, when everything will have been worked out, when there no longer is the necessity for struggle? I remember every time I speak to a group of white people, they always ask the question after you talk about the conditions and the problems and the power struggle. They always ask the question, isn't it true though that someday we'll all be together and there won't be any black and white? They just, really, won't you please say that? I'll accept everything else you say if you just say that there will come a time when all this struggle and conflict is over and we'll all be together. You know, it's asking always for Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream for America. It's asking, people want that kind of a solution to the problem. You hate to think that day after day, week after week, year after year, life is not going to change in character. I don't care how old you live to be. You are going to be engaged in struggle, in conflict. There is not going to come a day when everything is going to be all right. Never. Conflict is an element of life. Struggle is an element of life. You are redeemed by as you participate in this struggle. This is the process of redemption. I know it would be so much nicer if we could look forward to a day when we would all overcome, when God would reach down and settle the problem, when you could go up and stand in front of God and say, I've fought the good fight, I've done the best I could, now judge me and put me out to rest. Take me someplace and let me rest. But it doesn't come. Not as long. The only rest you get is when you stretched out on a slab. There is no other way. As long as you live, you will be engaged in struggle. Now, for some of you children, that may sound like a horrible gospel, but it's true. There is no time at which now you suddenly you are an adult and you no longer have any problems. When you get to be an adult, the problems have increased. And when you get to be an adult, you look forward then and say, well, there'll come a time when I have saved money, I got my house, I got money in the bank, I can retire, and then things will be all right. When you get to that place, you've got more problems than you ever had before in your life. There is no such time. Now then, let us look at life as Jesus tried to teach as he walked about. Not as the pagans distorted it later on. When Jesus walked about, he talked to men about living today. He said, do this. Love your brother. Be concerned about other people. All of these things make life worth living. There will never come anything else. This is it. Now you live it from day to day as best you can. This is the process of redemption. I know a lot of people come to church and they expect that something big is going to happen someday. You know, even in church, they come and they wait for something to explode in their head that's going to make them know that they're saved. It won't happen. If you saved, it'll be every day, just as you go along, the things you do. You get to be a better person if you try to be a better person. But it won't happen with an explosion. And there'll be no shining light when it comes. You just go along trying every day to do better and better, to get along with people, to be considerate, to stop lying and cheating and carrying on. And day by day, you'll get a little better in your relationships. But you'll never get to be perfect. Don't look for that. Because you'll still be doing a little bit of lying and cheating and stealing and sinning, even after you've tried. Even after you've tried as hard as you can. But if you're waiting for something to explode, you're going to be very disappointed. Because you keep thinking, nothing is happening to me. I'm trying to be Christian and nothing happens. I go along and nothing happens. I just don't see any big difference. Redemption is a process and it goes on from day to day. And that's all Jesus told men as he went around. He tried to heal, he tried to teach, he'd stop and play with the little children. The disciples said, don't waste time with the children, because they had the idea that something big was going to happen soon. And for Jesus, I might as well be playing with the little children. The children are just as important as anybody else. And nothing isn't going to happen all that big anyway, except crucifixion up the way, we're all heading for that anyway. But there is no big day coming when everything is going to work out. Now you can say we shall overcome and all the other things, but understand beneath it all, you believe in Jesus Christ, you believe in God, you have a certain way of life, and you live it. And you struggle, you fight, you have conflict day in and day out. And this is the pattern of life. This is the pattern of life, like it or not like it. And this is what Jesus tried to deal with when he walked around talking to people. I'll try to go into that a little more next week. Let us bow our heads in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank thee for this holy season. We thank thee for the opportunity to come together in thy house, to try to piece together the early beginnings of our faith. Be with us here and now. Give us a sense of thy presence. Give us a sense of direction, a sense of strength, a sense of dignity. And help us during this holy season to understand more clearly the message of Jesus for this day. Help us to make that message meaningful in our own personal struggle for meaning in our daily lives. And all these things we ask in his name. Amen.